Call the meeting of January the 8th, the year 2025, at 8:03 a.m. Heather has basically done roll call through people coming in on the phone. Can you confirm attendance and quorum, please?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. All board members are present and we have a quorum.
Thank you so much. Does anyone have any conflict of interest to declare on any of the listed agenda items for today? Alrighty, hearing none, we'll move on to the review of our minutes from the previous meeting of December 11, 2024. We first have our general session meeting minutes, and you all received an updated minute. Does anyone have any questions or concerns with those minutes, any additions or corrections? All right, hearing none, I will make a motion to accept the minutes as corrected.
I second.
Thank you. It's been moved and seconded to accept our general session meeting minutes of December 11, 2024. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Dr. Foreman, are you there?
I'm here. I got disconnected. Sorry.
Oh, we're just voting on general session minutes.
Aye.
Thank you. Any nays? No. All right, so it's those general session minutes have been approved. Our next is the executive session minutes from December 11, 2024. Does anyone have any questions or concerns, additions or corrections to those minutes? Hearing none, I'll make a motion to accept those executive session board meeting minutes as written. We have a second.
Second.
Thank you, Dr. Foreman, for that second. Moved and seconded to accept the executive session minutes as written. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is accepted. All right, we'll move on now to our investigation files. Or do we need to do, did you want to do the class, the other one first?
It's up to you.
Okay. Because time-wise with you, we're...
It might be easier to just get out of the way, right?
Okay.
Now.
So we're going to actually... Let's move to six. And this is a discussion, review discussion, possible action of the proposed consent agreement in the following manner. Matters that's listed below, complaint 24-14-C. Tasha Klotz, Doc Larios, DPM. You all received in the supplement from Heather the agreement that has been written. There was also the review materials that you have previously seen in regards to that case. The complaint is on the line, but this is not in an investigation status. We've done that, so this is just to make the decision here to accept the agreement that will essentially revoke the license of this physician. Does anyone have...
I am recused from this one.
That's right. Thank you for that reminder that, okay, so then... This, we still have quorum though, even with your recusal. Thank you for reminding. Does anyone have any remarks or questions they'd like addressed on this? You've all read this.
And the motion today, this is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. The motion today would be to accept the signed agreement for revocation of license, reject it, or modify it. I'm not sure what kind of modifications you'd want to make. If you did want to make those, we'd want to discuss those in executive session, but as you can see, it's already been accepted by the respondent. So.
All right. So, Dr. Foreman or Ms. Johnson Gray, if you have any remarks or comments, please present them at this time.
No new comments.
Thank you.
And none from me either. Thank you. Board Member Johnson Gray.
Thank you. Okay, then, hearing that we have no other remarks or comments, I will make a motion to accept the consent agreement for case for Dr. Klotzbach Larios, case number 24-14-C.
Seconded.
Thank you. It's been moved and seconded to accept the consent agreement for a proposed consent agreement for Dr. Tasha Klotzbach Larios.
Roll call.
Yes, and this requires a roll call vote, so we will take that vote at this time. Dr. Foreman?
Aye.
Ms. Johnson Gray?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell votes aye. Opposed? No opposition. We have one recusal, so there is no vote from our other board member. All right, so that consent agreement has been accepted, and Seamus will.
Nope, Heather.
Heather will take care of what needs to be done with the agreement. Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much. Okay, let's go back to 5, which is our items for board review, discussion, and possible action. We have our investigation file subheading A. Our first is complainant. The complaint number is 24-11-C. Stephen O'Brien, DPM, is present with counsel, Mr. Cody Hall. We have the complainant on the line. The initials for the complainant are PG, and our investigator on case is Dr. Polakoff. So Dr. Polakoff will give her report. Gentlemen, you're more than welcome to approach, have a seat. We're going to first hear from Dr. Polakoff on the report, and then we will hear from the complainant, and then from you, Dr. Bryant. So, Dr. Polakoff.
Good morning, board. This is Dr. Deidre Polakoff on case 2411C, Stephen O'Brien. The case involves a patient, PG, who presented to his office for concerns of foot pain. She was referred by her PCP. The patient did have surgery, and the post-op care is of concern for the timely pattern of when Dr. O'Brien saw the patient post-op and the post-op care that was provided before the patient was discharged from the practice. And I'll start with the beginning. The patient had surgery on June 26th of 24. In the post-op area of the surgical center, she reported pain. Surgery started at 6:45, ended around 7:15, and she was transported to recovery room by 8 o'clock. Around the 8 o'clock hour, in the morning, she was reporting pain. The nurses noted a level 5 out of 10, and she was given a pain pill and a Tylenol. The patient then was discharged, and when she went home, she did phone Dr. O'Brien's office stating that she was in pain and was advised appropriately to take some Tylenol, take a pain pill, and elevate, put ice on, follow the instructions. The patient then continued to call the office stating that she was in pain and the pain did not resolve. She was advised by the staff to double up on the pain pill and continue with all the other post-operative instructions. She phoned again on Thursday multiple times, on Friday multiple times, and then she did end up going to the emergency room due to pain. The patient phoned Dr. O'Brien again, stating that she did go to the emergency room and that they did not give her any pain medications, but they did check the wound and they took an x-ray. And she stated that the emergency urgent care center physician stated that everything looked good. The patient did call the doctor again on Saturday and on Sunday. Dr. O'Brien did call the patient back on Sunday and stated that she has been calling him too much, and for her to stop calling him and questioning her if, according to the patient, if she was a drug abuser. The patient stated that she's not a drug abuser to me, and that she lives in a sober home. Her son holds and controls all of her medications for her, and she only takes the medications as instructed. The patient was instructed to come into the office the next day, which is Monday, at 11:45. The office that she went to is the Phoenix office, which is 40 minutes away from her home. She is not familiar with that office. She did arrive early, she states, at the Phoenix office, parked, and by the time she walked from her parking place into the treatment physician's office, she stated that it was, instead of 11:45, it was 11:50, and Dr. O'Brien stated that she arrived at 11:55. She was told that she could not be seen at that time and that she needs to come back at 1:30. The patient stated that she begged the doctor to see her because it's so hard walking from the parking lot into the office, and the shoe, she stated, was hurting her, period. The patient stated that the shoe that she got from the surgical center appeared to be too short and her toe was sticking out the end. The patient did go back to her car, drove around, because she has a daughter who is severely mentally ill and she couldn't have her wait in the hot car. So she was paged by the office and they came back from lunch. She came back to the office and was treated by the doctor. My concerns from this incident were when the doctor heard that the patient was calling the day of surgery, which was Wednesday, and then again Thursday, and then again Friday, how come the doctor did not have the patient come back into the office either Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday to see if anything was physically wrong? Yes, the patient did go to an urgent care, but an urgent care physician is not, in my opinion, qualified to look at a fresh post-op of a foot. They do not know the intricacies of an implant, a fresh post-op, and the advanced knowledge that our field requires for this case. I think that if it were me, I would have seen the patient, even if it was after hours, on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, and not have the patient wait until following Monday for the check, which when she states that she was in severe pain. My other concerns in this case are that the patient stated that she did tell the doctor that she wants another physician because she felt that she and the doctor were not hitting it off and that the doctor was rude and basically unkind to her in her current condition. She did try to find another physician, and she asked the doctor for someone else, but he said that he was the only physician in his practice, and she said she was going to find someone else. She could not find someone else. So she did phone the doctor's office and stated that her foot hurts so bad that she would like to take some of the sutures out because that might make her foot feel better. The doctor said that if she takes the sutures out, he will not be responsible for her care. She did call the doctor's office and came in on a few weeks later, which was on the, just one second, I'll get the date for you in just one second, where she called the office and the assistant said to come in and she'll remove the suture. So she came to the office, the suture was removed, the patient had a new bandage put on, and she left. But the problem is, I do not see a note for the visit at all, that the patient did come into the office for a suture removal visit. The note was not included in any of the material that I received. I did have some difficulty with some of the doctor's dictation, and there was some carryover. The initial office dictation does not have any of the salient points that I do believe a podiatric physician should put into his notes. If the patient was having great pain with the phallus, the first ring, which is the bunion, then did the doctor perform any range of motion of the first ray? It's not in the chart. For dorsiflexion or plantar flexion of the first ray, did he do a gait observation and report, was there inversion, eversion, supination, anything of gait, which will have substance to later treatment for care? Did the doctor do a biomechanical exam to see how the Achilles was, how anything else was for the lower extremities? In review of the case, I do believe that information could have been added for a clearer view of the first initial visit as to the patient's ambulatory status, the bilateral foot exams, one compared to the other, was there a limb length differential? And the patient did have a history of depression and back problems, and she goes to a pain management doctor who puts her on baclofen 3 times a day. In this, if the patient was having so much pain, the doctor, instead of worrying about being bothered by so many phone calls, could have considered calling the pain management doctor and saying, I'm having questions with this patient's pain management. Would you like to take over pain management or give me advice as to what you would do for this patient? And maybe they could have worked out something that the patient would not have to have been in pain for so long post-op. I do believe that the allegation of unprofessional conduct in regards to pain management and post-op care is substantiated. Any questions?
Yes, I have a few. So, with the patient having a pain doctor, was there anything in the chart that indicated there was a pain contract, that should be the only physician that's giving prescriptions to this patient?
Nope, that was not in the chart.
Okay, and I had noticed, too, in the documentation that there was a note from the pharmacy, Arizona State, the prescription monitoring program. And this was back in the year 2000, though. There was an opioid disengagement letter that they noted that the patient was considered high risk for complications associated with opioid use and obviously discouraged the use of benzodiazepines with narcotics because that's a very lethal combination. I believe regarding the suture removal, it was indicated that there was an ER visit where those sutures were removed.
There were 2 visits. The doctor's office took out the top suture.
Right.
Okay, and that was not, there was no office note or dictation on that. And then she went back to the urgent care and had the other sutures removed and was given an antibiotic for precaution.
Okay, and in regards to the dictation issues about not having range of motion documented the gait analysis, because I do notice when the patient was seen by Dr. Discount, he noted the gastroxoleus equinus deformity at that time. The patient also, I mean, there's a history, there's obviously multiple medical problems going on here. And the patient is listed as diabetic and is taking metformin. We have low levels, there had been some low levels of vitamin D, decreased protein, which those are obviously signs for healing, could be an issue. I'm going to remark about the documentation in the operative report where it lists the implant as a size 6 millimeter. And we see in the documentation the direct implant material that says it's 16 millimeters. It's up to the physician, I believe, to review their documentation, their op reports, before they sign it. because that's very misleading to say that the patient has a 6-millimeter implant when there's not even an animal by that. You know, that's they don't, I think what the smallest was a 9-millimeter for lesser metatarsal. Anyway, so I just think that's something that physicians need to always, you read that op report. Yes, problems can happen in dictation, but you're the captain of the ship, and you need to double check your operative reports before you sign them. Also, too, in reviewing contraindications for use a lot of implants is inflammatory diseases. Now, yes, this patient has a history of gout and takes allopurinol and, I believe, colchicine. So the CRP was very elevated before that surgery. And if the person is effectively treated by those drugs, that CRP shouldn't be so high. So there's something else going on. And gout is considered an inflammatory disease process. And it says in the materials of the implant that a contraindication is inflammatory, like rheumatoid arthritis. Well, obviously gout is an inflammatory disease. And so I wonder, that was just something that maybe could have been maybe looked at a little bit closer in deciding about implants and not, you know, and going to start with a fusion. But I we want to try to keep range of motion for people because that's a younger patient and not to directly go to an arthrodesis.
Dr. Campbell, yeah. Are we still on questions for Dr. Polakoff?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just wanted to
make
sure.
And if she, okay. You know, if this is what her comments about those items are, because that was part of on the initial reports. That's why I'm asking those questions, or making comments, and then to ask for remarks back.
That all of it is correct from my brief 29-page report.
Oh, and you didn't see anything, was there anything in the documentation that indicated there was any conservative care, such as mention of orthotics? Now, I know there was inability to give steroid injections because it exacerbates her bipolar syndrome. So, was there anything else that was offered?
The doctor did do the standard, you know, there are complications or there are conservative therapy is orthotics, physical therapy, I believe all that, yes, that was in there.
Thank you. Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions, sir?
Yeah, I'm a little confused with the discharge part because it seems as though the patient said that she no longer wants to see the doctor. And isn't that considered to be a termination of the relationship instead of him not seeing the patient anymore?
There should have been follow-up with that. Even if the patient was saying that and she was obviously distraught and angry, the doctor should have initiated a letter, certified, email, handed her in person, whatever, that she needs to follow up with her PCP, urgent care, she needs to follow up with another doctor, and that her care should be continued, and they will be glad to refer her to other physicians if she would like, but none of that. So, yes, there was part on her, but there's also part of the doctor that he needs to take the stand and say to follow up and complete the package. And the doctor did state that he spoke to the PCP, and I did subpoena the notes from the PCP. And he has a lot of his notes in there, the doctor's notes and other physicians' notes and physical therapy and everything else. But he doesn't have any note about a conversation with Dr. O'Brien saying that he will take on care or that the patient's not coming back to him or anything like that.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Ms. Johnson-Gray, do you have any questions, ma'am?
I do not.
Ms. Brown?
I do.
Okay.
I, in reading this, I thought that the doctor-patient relationship was severed by the doctor when the son said that they were going to report him to Adult Protective Services.
That was a conversation with the son after he drove the mother home. The son on his son's phone to the doctor, so it wasn't with the patient. So even if the doctor might have severed the relationship with the son, he hasn't severed it officially with the mother. So he should have sent the letter or some correspondence to the mother stating that in reference to you accusing me of adult protective issues with your care or your daughter's visit to my office, then I'm severing our relationship. That, I believe, should have been completed.
And my other question is, and again, I am not a physician, but don't doctors normally give a block of some type? Didn't I read something about a block that she was given after post-surgery? But yet she was complaining about pain. Was the doctor notified by the nurse that she was having pain so that he could come back and see why the block's not working?
The patient reported pain within 15 minutes of hitting the recovery room.
Right.
And according to the OR notes, the doctor did give a heavy 25 cc of marking, 0.5% marking plane, into the area, which is a lot of medicine. But the patient was having pain at level 5, and then later as the day progressed, the pain increased. The patient did ask the recovery room nurses, is the doctor going to see me? I want to know how it did. And the nurse, according to the patient, said the doctor already left.
So the patient had a block that was not working. The patient complained to the nurse that the block was not working. Was the doctor notified to be able to come back? I mean, I know the patient called the doctor. Was there anything about why the block wasn't working? Because even a day later, it should still be working, but definitely post-surgery, it should be working.
You would think, but in this case, according to the patient, the nurse just gave her medication, and the nurse, according to the notes, did not call the doctor. And the block, questionable if it was working or not. That's
what
why
would
I
cause a block not to work?
A block,
just from my knowledge.
Sure. A block might not work because the block could have infiltrated the tissue around it, but still it's absorbed through the tissue, so it could have worked, but at a lesser percent. The block could not work if there was something going on. What if there was a pinched nerve? What if when the suture was put in? What if a pinched nerve occurred when the post-op bandage was put on? No one knows. That's why I put in my letter that the patient could have been seen anytime post-op to make her feel better instead of waiting the following Monday to see her and then have her do all that walking. So I don't know why the block didn't work. But there are a lot of reasons that it could not work. It could be also a nerve could have been cut during surgery, but these are all just guesses as to why something didn't work.
Thank you.
I think I noticed too on the on the OR record that the patient was given Toradol.
Yes.
Which we know is a very strong anti-inflammatory used for bone pain and surgery, which is appropriate.
Yeah.
You know, I think too, when you've got, you know, Ms. Broman, and, you know, with your question to Dr. Polakoff, why doesn't a block work? You know, sometimes too, when, you know, when people are on so many medications, you know, you can have decreased effectiveness of that, and there's polypharmacy going on. Has this spurred anyone else to have any other questions for Dr. Polakoff? All right. Now we will go ahead and hear from our complainant,
And remember, we only refer to her by her initials, which is PG, and we've all read this lady's complaint. So I would ask her if she would summarize her experience. So please proceed.
Okay, well, it basically, exactly what Dr. Polakoff said. You know, after surgery, I was experiencing a lot of pain. I called Dr. O'Brien and I said, you know, I'm in a lot of pain. He said, go ahead and double up on the medications and, you know, give me a call. And if you need a refill, I'll go ahead and refill those for you. The doctor on call will refill those for you. So I thought that maybe there was more than one doctor in the practice that would refill those for me. Because he gave me like a 3-day supply or a 4-day supply, and of course I would run out because it was coming up on the weekend. And I would run out. So I called him and called him because, of course, he said double up on the meds. So I doubled up, and of course I would run out. So when I finally got a hold of him, you can hear his kids in the background. He said, you're harassing me and my family, and I don't appreciate it. He was very angry with me, and it struck me because I could hear his kids in the background when he was yelling at me, and it upset me, of course, because, you know, I could hear his kids in the background, and he's telling me I'm harassing his family, and it was like, wow, you know, and he's like, you're a drug addict. And I'm just like, I'm the farthest from a drug addict. I'm the mom of the special needs daughter. I can't be a drug addict. That's the furthest thing from, that was very offensive to me. So I left a bad taste on them. So I'm like, I can't have somebody taking care of me that's accusing me of being a drug addict. That is not okay. So, and I was like, okay, you know, I can't deal with this guy. I'm in a lot of pain. Then I'm, you know, having problems with the itchiness and the pain and just everything. So I said, after a while, I said, well, what's going to happen with these stitches? I'm worried about them. They're itchy. I'm going to have them taken out at some point. What do I do? What's going on with these? And I'm like, where do I go? Because I'm not comfortable seeing you. What's going to happen with these stitches? And he goes, well, you can't take them out yourself. Come in and we'll get them taken out for you. So I went into the, he was like, let me see your foot. He sent me to the Phoenix office, which is like a 10-hour drive. Now, I take my son and my daughter with me. And by the time it's a really far walk. And left to get up in the elevator. Now, my daughter is autistic, and she's a lot bigger than me. And when she has fits, she's very physical, and she fights herself and jumps up and down and has a hard time going to public places. Well, we have to take her. So by the time we get up there, he's in the office, and we see him and the receptionist, and he goes, well, we're taking lunch now. And I'm like, I mean, this is in the middle of summer, and my daughter's hot. We just walked for like 10 minutes from the parking lot, get to the office, say, well, we're taking lunch now. And I'm like, you know, we just have to walk all this way, and then my daughter's hot and upset. So I have to walk all the way back down, and my foot's killing me, and my daughter's upset. So we get in the car, and she starts hitting herself and biting herself, and then through the driving truck, he starts grabbing at us from the back seat and screaming and hitting. And that's when it's like, my son's like, you know, thinking about calling Adult Protective Services because it's upsetting her so much. And when she's hitting and grabbing and screaming, if we're trying to drive, you can't steer when somebody is in the back seat trying to unbuckle herself and hitting and screaming. It's dangerous. We have to park and wait for him.
Ma'am, I'm sorry to interrupt you, could you keep your comments? We understand the situation. You've explained it, but could you hear more your complaint to what is with directly affecting you?
Okay.
Okay.
So that situation, though, So we'll go back to the stitches. So they say, come into the town office, phone the nurse if you got your stitches. I'm like, great. So I go in, you snip three parts right where the tie is. Just snip where the tie is. I say, there you go. And I'm like, that's it? They say, yep. So I'm like, okay, so all you did was just snip where they were. So I'm like, well, what do I do? Okay. So they were just snipped. So I'm like, well, what do I do with that? Like, do I just pull on them? I don't know what to do. So I don't know if it's later that night or the next day that I have to go to the urgent care across the street and have them take them fully out. And then they gave me that antibiotic to wrap my foot. And still, I'm still waiting to, I still have pain in that foot. I'm still waiting for a podiatrist to help me fix that foot. Or toe, I mean. So basically everything Dr. Polkoff said, but with the, what I just told you.
Thank you. So now it's the time that the board members can ask you questions, ma'am. So I have some to ask you. Do you have a signed pain contract with your pain doctor?
A signed pain contract?
Right.
Yes, I do.
Okay. So does that mean, with that pain contract, that is the only physician that should be dealing with your pain issues?
It depends. Sometimes I'm on pain medication, and sometimes I'm off pain medication. I have to go back on pain medication because of my toe. Recently. I was off pain medication for a couple of years until my toe operation.
Okay.
So I had to go back on it. I was off my pain medication for a couple of years until my toe operation.
Okay.
So I was on pain medication from an accident in 2018, where I take digestive medication too for my bipolar disorder, so I take benzodiazepines.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on benzodiazepines and pain medication from a car accident, and I was off of them until I had the surgery. And since I was treated from Dr. O'Brien, I had to go back on the pain medication.
Have you had other surgeries where you developed painful scar tissues or adhesions?
I've had other surgeries, but I haven't developed scar tissues. I've had kidney stones, mm-hmm. but I've never been on pain medications for that. Only been on pain medications from a car accident.
Okay. Well, no, what I'm talking about is if you'd had painful adhesions or anything from other surgeries. Doesn't
no.
sound like it. Okay. When you became a patient of Dr. O'Brien's, did you sign office policies that regarded, you know, missed late appointments or any of the other office protocol?
If it's part of like the intake paperwork,
yes, ma'am.
Like the standard
mm-hmm.
stuff,
yes, ma'am.
Then I must have.
Okay. So you were in the ER twice. The first time was on the day of the surgery, or the next day.
I can't. Probably the next day.
Okay.
And then the suture removal.
Okay. And the first time they did not give you any pain medications and they didn't give you antibiotics, but they did on the second visit to the ED when they took out your sutures, they did give you antibiotics at that time, correct?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, they gave me antibiotics. Okay. I thought something was wrong, like with my foot. I hadn't taken x-rays because I thought like something was wrong.
Mm-hmm. So now, and two, your pain doctor mentioned that most of the pain that you are experiencing currently, which I think they made this mention of this when they saw you maybe in September of 24, that the pain was due to problems with your back and that you take baclofen?
Yeah.
Okay.
September 24, it was noted that I had pain in my foot and it radiated down. My toe and it radiates down into my foot.
Alright. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for answering my questions, and I will ask my other board members if they have some questions for you. Dr. Foreman.
Yes. This is Dr. Foreman. My question is, when you were not getting any satisfaction from Dr. O'Brien, did you call your pain doctor to tell him what was going on?
No, I did not, because at that time I wasn't seeing my pain doctor
for
any pain meds. So I didn't think by starting up with him again, because by starting up with him again, I didn't, let me explain this, because when you have a, I'm taking psychiatric meds, and then by calling my pain doctor again, it would start up that whole, they have that monitoring process.
Right. You were, you weren't under a contract then at that time.
Yeah.
You were,
so I, okay. It was supposed to be for a short period of time that I was taking pain meds.
Okay.
I didn't want to call him and start up that whole process again. I just wanted to take a short period of time of pain meds, not start the whole pain med process again. I just want to be on pain meds for a short period of time, not a long period of time with the pain doctor.
That explains it. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Ms. Johnson Gray, do you have any questions?
I do not.
Thank you. Ms. Broman.
I've got two questions for you. It's stated in the notes that I read that you said oxycodone did not work for you, but yet you were prescribed it. Did you tell Dr. O'Brien when he first prescribed it that that's something that doesn't normally work when you called his office?
I said this pain medication isn't working for me, and he said double up on it.
Okay. And when you went to his office with your son, it's my understanding your son does drive because he drove you to the surgery, I believe, correct?
Yes.
So when you were running late for the appointment, why did he not drop you off in the front?
Because he had to help me out with walking and getting out with my daughter. So he had to help me out with just everything.
Okay.
You don't understand that when my foot, it shows my back, because I still have back problems. With my toe being injured, it throws my gait off and exacerbates my back injury.
But wouldn't it be worse if you parked far away and had to walk all that distance?
I have to rely on him to help me get my, unless I get like a wheelchair or something, I have to rely on him to help hold me up.
Do you have a handicap?
Maybe it was just an error. Maybe it's just an error in thought.
Do you have a handicap placard or license plate?
No, I do not. I thought that my foot injury was not going to turn into a handicap. I thought I was going to get a surgery to make me better, so not have to have a handicap placard.
I do have another question, ma'am. You saw Dr. Discount. What did he recommend to you?
Another surgery.
Which was to fuse your joint?
Yes.
Did he discuss any more with you, maybe getting you into an orthotic to help the function and help the mechanics of your foot function better? And
yes, he referred me to another doctor, and I'm that doctor, it seems like nobody really wants to touch me right now because the surgery was done, it's such a fresh surgery. So I'm still trying to find a doctor that's willing to work on my foot right now.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you answering our questions and letting us know your side of the story.
So now we will go ahead and hear from Dr. O'Brien and his counsel, Mr. Cody Hall. Mr. Hall, if you wanted to make remarks first or however, go ahead, please.
Good morning, members of the board. Cody Hall for Dr. O'Brien. I'm going to make a brief opening statement addressing two issues. I'm not going to address the clinical issues. I'm going to leave that to Dr. O'Brien and to your questions for him. But I do want to address the two issues that I think almost more like legal issues. I want to start off by addressing the issue with the apparent confusion over the patient's allegation that Dr. O'Brien called her a drug addict, and he set her up by telling her to double up on her pain medication. I'm sure all members of this board are very well aware of the opioid crisis and epidemic that's been going on for the last few years and all the new rules and regulations that are in place. It is reasonable and appropriate for a healthcare provider to provide a 5-day prescription for opioids after a surgery. In fact, you do longer than that and you're running a risk of getting a board complaint because you are prescribing outside the accepted parameters of what the state has determined as at least an initial prescription to be provided. And the patient is having pain out of disproportionate to the expectations. It would be certainly reasonable to say, well, you've got some more pain pills, you can take them PRN, you can take them if you need to. He didn't tell her to double up on her medication in the hopes that she would run out and still be in pain. He actually had a reasonable expectation that she would achieve a sufficient pain control. Obviously, nobody in this room was on any of the phone calls between the doctor and the patient, but I would find it very difficult to believe that any doctor would accuse a patient of being a drug addict. Much more likely, he probably said, I'm concerned about signs of drug-seeking behavior. And maybe that was heard as you're calling me a drug addict, but the fact of the matter is she had reported that the pain medication didn't work for her. She went to the ER. In her complaint, she reports to this board that she went to the ER just to get her foot looked at. But if you read the ER note says she is here for pain medications, and they wouldn't give them to her. Is at least a reasonable belief to interpret this behavior as consistent with a patient who's demonstrating signs of drug-seeking behavior. It doesn't mean that that's what they're engaged in. At least a reasonable interpretation of requests for different pain medications, going to different providers for pain medications, and asking for more pain meds that appears to be disproportionate to what the expectation is consistent with concerns about being a drug-seeking behavior. The other issue I just want to really quickly address before turning it over to Dr. O'Brien is related to the termination of the podiatrist-patient relationship in this case. It's fairly evident, the patient just told you that when she believed she had been called a drug addict, that it was very offensive to her. She said she could not have someone treating her who thought she was a drug addict. So that's consistent with the text messages that she was sending to the office as well, in which she says, you accused me of doing that, being a drug addict. You've intentionally set me up. I will not see you again, as I am afraid of you and what you are capable of. You're out of line, sir, and I will report you. This is our last correspondence. That was on June 30th. Dr. Wright did go out of his way to try to get her in, though, even after this text message concerns, because he knew she still had the stitches, and this was relatively close to the time of the surgery. Made arrangements to be seen in the Phoenix office the following day on July 1st. Now, the patient, when she was just telling me, she goes, he scheduled her for the Phoenix office. No, the chart clearly reflects that she was offered an appointment in the Chandler office, but Dr. O'Brien was not in the Chandler office on July 1st. He was there July 2nd. The patient made the decision to drive to Phoenix to be seen. She was given a choice. She knew it was 45 minutes to an hour, but yet she chose to drive in to be seen. And I think everybody can tell from her comments and what we put in the complaint, the response, that appointment didn't go well. The patient was very upset. And the patient says that she was upset because he wouldn't see her because she walked in and they were closing for noon. She had to go back out to the car. As we did raise in our response, she texted the doctor basically saying she was late. That is what her text message to the doctor says. Unfortunately, I was not able to make it in time because walking fast hurt my foot. And again, I did point out in my response that we submitted that, again, I've not had the opportunity to meet the complainant, so I was not aware that she needed assistance getting out of the car. That was not included in her complaint. It was certainly reasonable if she was running late to get there, her son could have stopped and gotten her out and gotten his sister out, and so she wouldn't have been late for the appointment. But even then, once she gets inside, she's resistant to treatment, and she's made it known that she no longer considers this to be a podiatrist-patient relationship. He didn't abandon her. In fact, he continued talking to her after that. So I just take some offense that with the suggestion that under the circumstances, a reasonable podiatrist has to send a letter that says, oh, you told me that I'm scaring you. You told me that I am... you're not comfortable with me. I called you a drug addict, and so therefore, I'm going to have to terminate this relationship. That I don't think that is standard of care. The patient terminated the relationship by clear statements. The text messages that were sent that were referred to by Dr. Polakoff were sent from the same phone. So the son who threatened to report to APS is doing it from the same phone number in which the patient is also complaining to Dr. O'Brien. So it's fairly evident that she knew that her son was making the threat that he was being reported to APS. And then I'm just going to dovetail real quickly into kind of her argument about the stitches, saying that he suggested the stitches. She actually texted him on June 30th and says, I need to know if these stitches are dissolving since I'm infected. I will be cutting the stitches out to relieve infection. She's the one who first brought up the issue of doing this. Dr. O'Brien promptly responded to her and said, as I said yesterday, you can get into the office as early as today if you want to see me. I won't be prescribing more narcotics without seeing you in person. The sutures are not dissolvable and will need to be removed, but removing them right now is way too early and will lead to serious wound healing complications. I have to advise you not to do that. So even after she's threatening him, telling him she's in trouble, he's still going to see her. He sees her, and he tries to provide appropriate instructions to her. So those are just my comments on the abandonment and the drug-seeking, drug-addict behavior. And I'm going to turn it over to Dr.
Excuse me.
Nope.
Ma'am, you've had your time. This is the attorney, the counsel, and the doctor's time. Thank you.
Okay.
And I'm going to turn it over to Dr. O'Brien to address some more clinical questions that you all have raised this morning, as well as his response.
And thank you, Mr. Hall, for bringing up the Opioid Epidemic Act, because that was in my notes, because, yes, yeah, 5 days.
Yep.
It's all that's allowed. And then if you want to get more meds for your patient, there's a lot of hoops to be jumped through.
There certainly are, particularly for a person who's previously been on a pain contract.
Exactly. Dr. O'Brien.
Thank you, Board, for this time to discuss this matter. I just wanted to make a few follow-up comments on some of the things that were said today. In regards to the narcotic prescription, yes, it is true. We have to be very careful how we prescribe those medications. I generally, as a general protocol, will prescribe 5 days worth of the medication. It's not uncommon for everyone deals with pain differently, especially those who have chronic opioid use and mental health disorders. Some people, pain is a very subjective thing. It's not always an objective finding, but some people respond differently to surgery in way of pain than others do, and it can be somewhat unpredictable. In this case, I did speak with PG on Wednesday evening after was the day of the surgery, that evening when she paged me, and I did explain to her that if she needed to, she could take two of the oxycodone, which would be 10 milligrams, is still within the realms of a safe dose. However, I did inform her that she had to be careful when doing that, that she didn't run out of the medication, because we do not prescribe narcotics without an evaluation in the office. And so that was mentioned to her when she called back to the office Thursday morning. When I was in seeing patients, I did not have direct communication with her as I was in with other patients. However, I did speak with my nurse as well as my medical assistant multiple occasions that day when she had called into the office giving recommendations for pain. We recommended other medications such as gabapentin, which she refused. We recommended Tylenol. I recommended a muscle relaxer. However, it was brought to my attention that she was already on baclofen, and so I wasn't able to put on another muscle relaxer at that point. She made comments to my office that she was going to start mixing her medications if we couldn't give her anything else. And that was my first indication that she might be exhibiting drug-seeking behavior. We did not hear from her again through the remainder of that day. And we did not see her in the office that day. It was the day after her surgery, and again, we were in our Phoenix office. But I did not hear from her the rest of Thursday. I did not hear from her all of Friday. The next time I heard from her was Saturday after she went to the ER. And I did communicate with her on Saturday through text message. I reiterated to her that she was seen in the ER. They had x-rays done. Nothing was found to be wrong. They didn't prescribe her more pain medication and didn't find that she needed a refill in her medication. It wasn't until Sunday, when she continued to page me throughout the weekend, that I said she needed to, and I called her and I said that I was concerned that she was expressing drug-seeking behavior. I never called her a drug addict. I said she was showing drug-seeking behavior, and I wouldn't be prescribing her any more narcotic medication. And that's where the misunderstanding occurred. She misinterpreted that as me calling her a drug addict, and that is when she said she no longer wanted to see me. We did see her in the office the next day after she was making threats to remove her sutures. I did see her. It is true that she had to wait to be seen because she showed up right as we were closing for our lunch break. However, it should be noted that this is a large medical complex. There are many lobbies and common areas where they can sit in the air-conditioned building. It's not... it was her choice to go back to her vehicle. And as soon as the office reopened at 1 o'clock, we sent her a message promptly stating that we were open. She could come wait in our lobby. As far as abandonment of the patient, I believe I did everything I could and more to provide excellent care to her. When she and her son were both messaging the office through the same number, were making false accusations about physical and emotional abuse that I had, that they had received from me, and said that they no longer wanted to see me. That was when I called her primary care provider, who I know very well, and said that this is what had happened. That there had been a breakdown in our relationship, and I was worried about this patient, and I was turning the care back over to her primary care provider, who had initially sent her to see us. And there, in the document, there is record of that conversation with the primary care provider. As far as the clinical aspects of this case, I think my response clarifies the clinical concerns. The claim that the implant was undersized, if you look at the clinical trial that was done and presented in this case, it's well in the realms of what's standard. The size of the implant, it is true that in the op report there is an error in the dictation that says 0.6 millimeters when it was actually 16 millimeters, the implant, and that's a documentation error on my part. However, if we look at the record from the surgery center, and if we look at the x-rays, it's very clear that the implant was within the normal sizes that would be used with this particular implant, and that the surgical technique was in line with the standard of care. I did see the patient postoperatively in the PACU or the post anesthesia care unit. The patient was resting peacefully. Her vitals were stable. She was making no claims of pain out of control, nor did I receive any calls from the facility regarding pain out of control. No, I did not stay and wait for the patient to wake up from anesthesia. That's not necessarily standard of care. She's under the care of a nurse as well as an anesthesiologist, and I have patients I have to get to in my office, but I did see the patient and speak with the nurse after surgery, which is standard protocol. There were claims by the investigator that these sesamoids have been, quote, sawed in half. I find this to be unfounded. There's no mention of this in the ER, the X-ray, the radiologist report from the ER or from Dr. Discount, who later saw her in his office. I think, generally speaking, any type of sesamoid fracture generally requires an MRI or CT, so I don't think that that's something that we can state as fact. Excessive shortening. There's a guide that we use when performing this procedure that was followed in exactness. So that the there's actually a cut guide for cutting the first metatarsal. It's not something that we do with other implants where it's kind of an eyeball type cut. This is done with a cut guide following the appropriate technique, which is removing up to 6 millimeters of bone. Should also be indicated that when I first did see PG, I did recommend an arthrodesis given her chronic inflammatory conditions and just overall better long-term results with this procedure. However, this was something that she refused and ultimately requested that we do an implant arthroplasty as an alternative to the original arthrodesis that I had recommended. Pardon me, I just scanned through my notes here. As far as the decision to perform surgery on this patient, it's always a tricky decision with any patient. Many times patients are sent as referrals to our office as a surgical consult. Much of the conservative treatment happens many times before they arrive in our office. This is a patient who had long-standing pain in her great toe due to gout and other inflammatory conditions, as well as her documented arthritis on exam. She had come into my office after recently been seen in the ER because her pain was to the degree that she had to seek emergency treatment. And she came in requesting a definitive procedure. As I documented in my notes, and I always do, I outlined conservative treatment options, being it all orthotics, shoe modifications, anti-inflammatory medications, even offering a cortisone injection. In this case, all of those treatment options have been already offered and exhausted prior to her presenting to my office. At that time, that was when we discussed arthrodesis, and that was the initial plan. She presented back to my office at her request to discuss alternatives to fusion. She did not want to have a fusion, and she requested that we do an implant. We discussed the risks, potential risks, and benefits of each, and ultimately, as a provider and patient, decided on the implant, which was reasonable considering her history. I did send her to her primary doctor for a medical clearance. She was medically cleared for surgery. I did look at her lab work. Yes, some of her labs were abnormal. However, I would argue that most of these are most of these abnormalities are minimally outside of the normal parameters. The CRP is the one that's more elevated, but as we discussed, with someone who has chronic inflammatory conditions like gout, it's not uncommon to have an elevated CRP, and I do not believe this is a complete contraindication to surgery. In fact, this only shows that she has these inflammatory conditions that need to be appropriately addressed. Uh, There was a biomechanical exam documented as far as the range of motion of the hallux. No, I did not comment on the Achilles tendon or equinus contracture. I was more, in this case, being focused on the complaint, which is the pain in the great toe. There were radiographic findings of arthritis in the great toe, and did not, in my professional opinion, see how the equinus would have a significant impact in how we treated this this deformity of the great toe. I think I've covered everything from a clinical aspect, and so I guess at this point I would ask for any questions from you.
Okay. So what in your office, Dr. O'Brien, is your late or missed appointment policy?
Our late or missed appointment policy. So our missed appointment policy, we're, if it's during office hours, we routinely see patients who are late. If they miss an appointment completely without notification, there, we do charge a $50 fee to patients for missing an appointment, which is our office policy. If they are late but they present during office hours, we always work them into our schedule. The problem with this scenario was, you know, we offered her that same day appointment for 11:45. We advised her that we do close for lunch at noon, and she showed up 11:55, I think it was. I never spoke to her when she first appeared. She spoke to my front desk staff that said, you know, she was 10 minutes late, we were closing for lunch, we'd be happy to see her at 1 o'clock, even though our schedule was full. She was more than welcome to wait within the building. So to answer your question, we do see patients who show up late if it's during business hours, but I have to respect my staff, you know, their hours as well.
Yeah, it affects everyone in the office. Now, and I think you did answer this, but I'll just... So the patient did understand that it, if an implant failed, a fusion would be necessary?
Correct.
Thank you so much. Ms. Borman, do you have any questions for the doctor?
Can you come up with any reasons why that initial block didn't work? And why, I mean, she didn't, she, at one point I saw that she was asking for lidocaine. I don't know whether or not that would have done anything. But if, it's my understanding, I mean, you're given 5 days of medication. Okay, I don't know much about opiates, but I understand that we do have a crisis, and I totally understand that. But if you give 5 days of medication and then you tell them to double up, it tells me, you know, two and a half days. How can you tell somebody to double up but that you only have five? So it's one or the other. You know, I mean, to tell her to double up maybe once to see whether or not it worked, but it didn't sound either in your notes or from what she said that you... It almost sounded like you said, we'll just double up, which means that you're going to give her something else. But she also said that the oxycodone wasn't working for her, and she was asking for something else, including lidocaine, which, again, is not a drug, per se. So that threw me off on that whole, you know, double up, well... And you have to add by saying, but you have to come into my office sooner because I can't prescribe anything else. But that was not in any of the notes or what she said. And the second comment that I would make is, I understand that it does affect staff if somebody is late. But under the circumstances, she just had surgery. She's been complaining to you every single day, annoyingly so, according to some of your remarks. Continuously since the surgery about her pain. She does have an issue with her daughter, which you're aware of, and you might, to because she was, she said 5 minutes, you say 10 minutes, I'll give you 7 minutes late. Why wouldn't you still see her under the circumstances? This is just a matter of compassion. I understand you can do what you want and say, okay, well, I need you for 15 minutes, but again, I am not a doctor, but I have been in business for many, many years, and I don't understand that under just sheer compassion. Just at least for 5 minutes.
So, 10 minutes. I think there were three things brought there that I will address. As far as, again, you know, whether, you know, the narcotics, telling her to take two at a time, how is it she's not going to run out? It was very specific when I said that. I said, if you need to take two at a time for breakthrough pain, you can do that, but you need to monitor how often you do that, because if you take two at a time every 4 hours, you are going to run out. And it needs to last you until your follow-up appointment with us. We do not prescribe narcotics without an appointment in the office. So I did specify to her, this is more for breakthrough pain, and this is something I do not infrequently. The first couple days sometimes can be the worst, and then it improves. So if they have to double up on it a few times during those first couple days, and then after that they can taper down to every 6 hours, they can generally make it work. So I did I did clarify with her that, you know, I was not telling her to take two oxycodone every 4 hours going forward, because she would definitely run out before her follow-up appointment. This was for breakthrough pain that I was advising her to take, to double up as needed, but to be careful with how she doses that. We also, again, also did recommend several other modalities for pain control, Tylenol, gabapentin, which she refused, and then, you know, normally I'll do a muscle relaxer, but she was already on a muscle relaxer, so I couldn't double up on that. When she's asking for lidocaine, lidocaine is given through an injection. It's not an oral medication. The only one that can administer that is myself. The first time she asked for that was when she was paging me on Saturday, she had gone into the ER. Would that have made a difference? Lidocaine generally lasts for about 4 hours. So maybe it would have made a difference for 4 hours. But that's not standard care, to do a lidocaine block on someone 2 days after surgery for post-operative pain. That's not standard of care. As far as seeing her in my office, and again, I believe we made we did everything we could to try and see her that day, even though we had a full schedule. I never spoke to her when she checked into my office late. I didn't even know she had been there. She spoke to my front desk, who said, "We are closing in 5 minutes. You are 10 minutes late. That's not enough time for the doctor to see you." They could have just said, "We won't see you today." What they said is, you know, if you can come back at 1 o'clock, we'll fit you into our schedule. That's an hour later. This is in a large medical complex where there's plenty of waiting rooms. I was not aware. She, you know, in her statement, she said that she spoke to me, and I said, quote unquote, "I'm taking an early lunch." That never happened. I never spoke to her, nor were we taking an early lunch. We were taking our scheduled lunch at 12 o'clock. I never spoke to her until after that lunch break, when she came back into the office and we fit her into our schedule. So there are certain protocols that we have to maintain for my staff, and I believe we I'm sorry.
Oh, she's no. Go, please continue.
I believe we made every accommodation we could to see her that day, even though she wasn't on the schedule. Should I answer all your questions? Why the pain? Okay, so that's an interesting question. I said this before, and I'll kind of reiterate, pain is a subjective finding. It's not an objective finding. There's no way to objectively, the closest way we have to objectively measure pain is maybe through vital signs. You know, someone's increased heart rate, that can be, you know, or increased blood pressure due to pain. Her vital signs after surgery were normal. People experience pain differently. Sure, it's possible that my block was ineffective. I mean, that happens. Is it also possible that because of the many medications she's on, her long-term use of opioids and benzodiazepines, that she doesn't have that same tolerance, or she's going to, sometimes even anxiety can be perceived as pain in some of these situations. So it's hard for me to answer why it didn't block, but or why the block did not work. I would argue that it maybe did work, But in this particular situation, due to her some of her history, she was experiencing this subjective pain that was out of proportion.
Did you remind her that elevation and ice work nicely for pain control?
We do, and that's in all of our post-operative instructions as well, that loosening the bandage if needed, icing, elevating is always recommended for the first week.
Dr. Foreman, did you have questions?
No, I have no questions.
Ms. Johnson-Gray, question?
Yes, I do. I have a couple. Hi, Dr. O'Brien. So I have a few questions. First, so you were aware of the previous pain management plan that the patient was under, correct?
I was aware that she had previously been under the management of pain management. I was not aware that she was currently under their care.
Okay, I think she stated that he was not at the time, but I was just asking, were you aware that he had previously been under a pain management plan with the physician?
I only knew from her medical history from the primary care provider that she had chronic pain. That's the extent that I knew, and that was was discussed with me in the preoperative appointments.
Okay. And then, secondly, I know you stated that you did notice some abnormal labs, and I wanted to ask, in hindsight, is there anything in that you think may have affected how the pain medication did not help with her pain?
Nothing that would specifically indicate that the pain medication would not be effective for her in her labs. And again, I didn't find any of these labs to be that remarkable. It was only brought up in the investigator report.
Okay. And then also, the record shows that you prescribed her 5 milligrams of oxycodone. And I wanted to know if there was a reason why decided 5 and not maybe 9 to 10 milligrams, which may have resulted in an adequate relief for her, especially since she had a history of pain management.
Yeah, so 5 milligrams of oxycodone is my general protocol for this procedure. I believe I prescribed her 30. I rarely, if ever, prescribe 10. For a number of reasons. One, if I'm prescribing them 10 and they're still having pain, I can't have them double up on it, you know, for breakthrough pain, because that would be outside of the safe dosage. Also, you know, this is considered a fairly minor procedure as far as foot and ankle surgery goes, and I felt that 5 milligrams should be adequate, especially along with other pain controlling modalities such as Tylenol, gabapentin, and so forth.
Okay, so knowing that you told her that she may need to double up for breakthrough pain, then of course that outcome would result in her having less than 5 days of pain medication to accommodate her pain potentially. Did you think that maybe because I'm kind of in the same space with my co-board member in regards to knowing that doubling up would have shortened the days that she would have had by pain relief medication. And you stated that she would have to come back in the office for evaluation to be prescribed more medication, correct?
That's in our office policies, that all patients sign that when they first come in, stating that we do not give narcotic prescriptions are refills without an appointment in the office. That's correct.
Dr. O'Brien,
okay.
may I interrupt here just to give more information to the board members regarding the Opioid Epidemic Act that was put into place under Governor Ducey. And what that indicates is, again, the act places a five-day limit on an initial opioid prescription, okay? And that's the law in the state. Now, the only, if there's an individual who's already receiving opioids for chronic pain, then things are different. But the patient indicated to us that she hadn't been under pain control, she hadn't been receiving pain management through the pain management doctor only for this surgery. So that does not apply to her. So the bill also says that, you know, prescriptions that are for pain medicines must be transmitted electronically. So that way we don't have people trying to alter prescriptions, which happens out there. And it prohibits the Senate bill, which was 1001, prohibited new prescriptions for Schedule II opioids to exceed 90 morphine milligram equivalents. So, as the doctor mentioned, there, you know, we have a limit, a safe limit that's given, and this is by law. So the doctor has to follow the law with regards to, you know. So again, I think there was a misunderstanding here of what doubling up meant. You know, we don't know how much elevation in ice was occurring and other things to help with the pain control. So I hope that kind of sheds a little bit of light on how that law works. Yes, we may find it not compassionate to give people a bunch of medication, you know, to help them with their pain, but the physician also must follow the law.
I do understand. That's why I was asking, you know, based on her history of pain management, why was 5 milligrams prescribed, you know, for that 5 day, within that 5 day period, instead of maybe a 9 to 10 for a surgery that, you know, could be moderate to severe pain.
Right.
So I just wanted to know his take on that part.
Because, you know, exactly, and as we've all, you know, the discussion has been, pain is subjective, you know, and you don't want to over-medicate, you know, you go on, you know, the patient's history, the size of the patient, you know, a smaller patient, I'll say someone like myself, if I received 10 milligrams, I probably wouldn't wake up for 24 hours. So, you know, there's a lot of difference, and the doctor's not going to know. We don't have a crystal ball to see how the patient is going to respond. The other remark I want to make before we discuss this case and adjudicate it is, and I talked about this, mentioned this before at a previous meeting, and I don't know how many hospitals are doing it, but I know they do in the Honor Health system in this state, that there's a program that's out there for physicians, surgeons, to work with the patient's PCP. When we have patients with these kind of issues that are planning on to have surgery, that there is a coordination of care pre-op, peri-op, and post-op. I would, you know, suggest to all licensees that's something that they look into to see, because we see more and more of these kind of diagnoses all the time. So I think physicians need to be educated and be, you know, better prepared for those kind of issues. Because again, and we have a lot of he said, she said here, and so we must decide if there was a egregious act that occurred. Was there a breach in standard of care, now that we've been able to hear from Dr. O'Brien and the complainant, and everybody has asked the questions. I hope if anybody has any other ones they'd like to ask, they will. But I would ask for any final comments from
board members, I don't think we need to, that I need to sit here and rehash every point. I think everybody knows what they are. So I would ask for any closing kind of comments or remarks, or if anyone has a motion they'd like to offer, please do so. Ms. Brown.
I have a comment.
Yes, ma'am.
This seems like a communication issue throughout, again. Saying double up on medication, somebody complaining about pain over and over and over between Wednesday and you don't see them until Monday, that to me is way too long, especially when they're complaining and when you're aware of their previous history. You knew that the patient had a history of depression and issues, etc., when you took her on, and knowing that, you still waited a very long time until you got her into the office. That is a concern of mine. Telling her to double up on medication to her meant whenever she has severe pain, from what I'm hearing from her, that means I can double up on medication. To you, it means do it once or twice. But you only have 5 days, and until I see you, I can't give you any more. That is a communication issue. This whole thing seems to be a communication issue. And I believe that that is one of the problems here.
So, yeah, I mean, we spoke for a Thursday morning. Can I answer the question?
Are these questions?
Yeah.
Are you just talking? These
yeah.
comments
these
for the board?
These are just comments
for the board discussion?
So comments. We're done, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
This is just a comment.
Yeah. Thank you. Ms. Johnson Gray?
Yes. I agree with my co-board member. I am concerned about the confusion of communication between the patient and the doctor. I am also concerned that the patient, after trying to, expressing the level of discomfort that she was experiencing, to be put on hold. And so I share that same sentiment as my co-board member. And that is of high concern to me. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Foreman.
Well, as a physician, when the patient did go to the emergency room right after the surgery and x-rays were looking good, there were no signs of infection, I probably would have the patient back a lot sooner than a couple of days. But as for pain management, if the ER didn't give any other different types of medicine, because we're stuck, as Dr. Campbell went over, with our amount of opioids that we can prescribe, what we can do. And we do tell people to go to the emergency room that they're having a lot of pain and what we prescribe don't work. And if the emergency room doesn't do anything, it's not a good situation for either the doctor or the patient, because that's not addressing their pain. There definitely was a lot of miscommunication going on in this, but I do not know if it falls below the standard of care. Thank you.
Well, I think, what we need to decide, yes, is it there was no egregious act. Is this something that the board would be offering maybe a letter of concern regarding all these issues that everyone has addressed, if they feel that's an appropriate action at this time. So if anyone wants to offer something like that, or if they feel, the discussion has been enough to alert the physician to problems and dismiss the case. I don't believe this is rising to any other level of discipline or anything. So I would offer, I'd like any other opinions, sure. And if someone has a motion they'd like to make, please do so.
I'd like to make a motion.
Sure, I'd like to...
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I'd like to make a motion that there be a letter of concern regarding communication, regarding time to, I mean, understanding when somebody complains. I don't know how to put this into words.
I think I can help you.
Okay.
So the board is concerned about the lack of, or, you know, miscommunication with the patient. Specifically, those concerns would be failing to bring the patient in sooner, mm-hmm. Failing to adequately explain the use of the opioids that were prescribed, and is there anything else that you were concerned about communication-wise? Failure to...
I personally am astounded that after all of this, that because they were 5 minutes late, they wouldn't be seen, but that's the prerogative. And that the office, even knowing how many times they called in with the pain and the problems, didn't tell the doctor that she was there, and hey, what should we do?
Failure to adequately monitor staff to provide that kind
Thank
of,
you.
To provide
yes.
information regarding yeah. patients.
Yeah.
Okay. So those are three things.
Thank you.
And is everybody clear on those three points? Do I have a second to Ms. Broman's motion?
This is Johnson Gray. I second that motion.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson Gray. All right. It has been moved and seconded to offer a issue a letter of concern to Dr. O'Brien regarding communication with patients, failing to bring patients in sooner, the use of the use of opioids prescribed, and staff monitoring. Do I hear any other discussion? Hearing none, we'll take our vote. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? The letter of concern will be issued. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Does anybody need a little recess before?
Five.
Yes.
Okay.
We'll take a 5 minute recess before the next case is reviewed. Thank you so much.
And if anything, it's